Welcome to Mumble Jumble, where we talk about ideas with people that make the world go round. I'm your host, William Yuen Yi. Cameron Kaufman is running to represent the New York State Assembly in the 73rd District, which consists of the Upper East Side, Midtown East, and Murray Hill. If he wins, he'll be the youngest New York State Assemblyman since Teddy Roosevelt, who won at age 23. Within hours of announcing his candidacy, Cameron created a media firestorm, raising over $100,000 from 200 donors. His candidacy is rooted in a progressive platform in favor of full marijuana legalization, support for the impeachment of Donald Trump, fixing retail vacancies, and recognizing the urgency of issues like climate change. So Cameron Kaufman, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. As a political talk show host for 3 years at Yale, it's so great to be back on campus doing a show and to be on the other side for once.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, you mentioned Yale. You graduated from Yale in May, and now you're running for New York State Assembly, which is a very unique thing to be doing right out of college. What inspired you to do that?
Well, yeah, it's definitely not the normal path, but I've lived in this district for my entire life, 22 years, and I've always been a passionate member of my community. I've always really cared about a lot of the issues that affect us on a day-to-day basis. And over the summer, I really said to myself, you know, I want to do something. And since 2016, I had said, I have to get involved some way. I need to make a difference. We had too many people sitting on the sidelines, and that's what led to what's been happening in our country. And I thought, you know, maybe do it on a federal level, whatever. And I said, you know, there's so many problems in our city and our state, so many things that need fixing. And we passed great legislation like the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. So we're working on climate change to become a state that gets to net zero by 2040. We actually have to get there. The next couple legislative sessions will determine that. We set a congestion pricing scheme, which is a good idea, but it's really going to hurt members of my district. So the next legislative session is going to be determining what the details of that look like. We have a retail vacancy crisis. You probably see it up here. It's really bad. Further down you go on the Upper West Side, it's pretty bad on the Upper East Side, about 14%. I see new business close basically every day. I wanted to fix that. So it was kind of a sense of urgency and understanding. I wanted to get involved. I wanted to do something and try and make a difference.
So definitely lots of issues you've mentioned, congestion pricing, you know, climate change. Can you tell me some other things about your platform? I guess what if someone who wasn't familiar with your candidacy asked, you know, what do you stand for? Can you talk a little bit about your broad overview of your platform?
Yes. So it's interesting. I'll kind of break it down in two ways. So on the first end, there's some broader principles that I really think are important that I'm trying to emphasize in my campaign. And it's that of full-time representation, listening, and ethical government. So the idea that we deserve a representative who wants to do it full-time. So no outside income, which is a law that I would be trying to pass the second I got into Albany to ban outside income. Congress has a 15% cap on that. New York State almost put a cap on it. Instead, the legislature got around it. They took a pay raise, and they didn't cap their outside income. So a lot of legislators, including the incumbent, make more money in outside jobs than they do in their six-figure legislative salary, which I think is pretty crazy. There's that. There's the idea, too, that just our ethics system is broken. And so we need representatives who want to serve correctly, want to serve in a way that embodies our democracy. And so we need better ethics organizations like our Joint Commission on Public Ethics, JCOPE. It has no teeth. It's not been doing a very good job. So it's stuff like that. And then there's some concrete policies. As you said, I mentioned congestion pricing, which is something that really it talks to broader transit issues, which I think is something that a lot of people in my neighborhood vote on. There's overdevelopment, which is something that people are really concerned about. There's a specific project, which we can get into, a redevelopment of a hospital, a $2.5 billion plan. We go into that. There's the retail vacancy crisis, which is another thing that's brought up at community board meetings. And then, yes, issues like climate change, something that I'm very concerned about. And, you know, otherwise, parts of this district could be underwater in decades if nothing's done about it.
Yeah, so I guess we can jump off with climate change. I think in the past you've said we need smart solutions. Can you talk a little bit about what those solutions look like?
Yeah, so New York passed the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which said get to net zero by 2050 as a state. I'm not sure 2050 is soon enough. I think we might need to do 2040. That's what the city said. And so I would advocate to make sure that you know, especially given when you pass climate change legislation, it seems that the can is almost always kicked down the road. We should be setting a more ambitious goal, and then maybe you hit 2050, but that's because you set the goal at 2040. So I would be really smart about that. But there's a lot of different infrastructure things that we can do, whether it's really investing in our electric car infrastructure – New York City, quite frankly, think about all the pollution that just comes from the hundreds of thousands of cars in the city plus the trucks. We need to be totally changing our transit infrastructure. Corey Johnson is working with the Speaker of the Council to ensure that we're going to have e-bikes and e-scooters and more bike lanes and busways and all the like. Because at the end of the day, we're going to need to have a city that is much less car-reliant. So when I say smart solutions, I'm saying an overhaul of our state, and especially focused here because this is the commercial epicenter of our state, focusing on revamping our entire culture to make sure that we are less reliant on cars. There's also some investments we could talk about off the Long Island Sound in terms of wind power. There's solar power stuff. And then, you know, in our state-owned buildings, we need to have better infrastructure. So, for example, dorms at Stony Brook University or at SUNY Binghamton or at SUNY Albany, we have contracts long-term on how to heat those and how to power those where we didn't sign it with an alternative energy company. You know, they're contracts from the early 2000s, from the 90s, when we had a different conception. We weren't as aware and active on climate change. So we need to find a way to deal with those, to actually update the infrastructure in our state-owned buildings.
So another issue that's being talked about a lot, and you mentioned this earlier in the introduction, was Northwell Health's Lenox Hill Hospital expansion, which has been roundly criticized by both you and many residents of the Upper East Side. What's the current status of this project? And I guess, what actions are you taking?
Yeah, so right now, the project, it's still in its planning phase, and it could enter ULURP. Hopefully, that's the Uniform Land Use Review Procedure. And once it enters that, it's a little bit harder to stop. And what they're calling for is a $2.5 billion overhaul. It's a hospital on Park Avenue and Lexington Avenue between 76th and 77th to gut the entire thing and rebuild it, and rebuild a hospital portion into a 500-foot-tall building on Lex, where the current height limit is 180 feet, and then to build a 500-foot-tall luxury condominium on Park, where the height limit is 210 feet, sell off that condo and that land to a private developer, and that's going to pay for the entire project. Now, the problem with this is, beyond the fact that you should not be building 500-foot-tall buildings when the height limit is 200 feet anywhere, and this 10 years of construction is going to devastate the neighborhood, will be unhealthy for the neighborhood, will hurt businesses in the neighborhood. Beyond all that, you actually look at what they're trying to do. They're not expanding the capacity of the hospital. The hospital's capacity is staying the same. What they're doing is they're going to make the hospital almost like a luxury VIP hospital. So a hospital for the wealthy, kind of modeled after what New York Presbyterian did. I mean, that's a hospital on 70th, 71st on the East River that has this beautiful VIP wing over the FDR Drive. And it's a massive hospital, and so there's plenty of other things. But they want to basically make this whole hospital into that because think about how valuable this tract of land is. It's between Park and Lex in the 70s, and it's Northwell's most profitable hospital, but they're only making $20 million a year in profit off that. They could be making tons more. Especially, you see what they're doing. They want to sell off the land to a private developer, and then they want to run up the margins on what they're keeping. So I understand what Northwell's trying to do. I don't think it's good for the community, though, and we should be opposing it. And it seems that we are. There's a task force that the borough president's convened. Our council member is taking a stand against it. My opponent is not. He claims to still be reviewing it, but I'm not exactly sure how he hasn't come to the conclusion that this would be bad for the community.
So, yeah, I guess let's talk about Dan Cort a bit. He's represented your district since 2011. He's never faced a primary challenger until now and has won re-election by four times by landslides over his GOP opponents. I think many polls say that he's relatively popular and he's a pretty prolific fundraiser like yourself. What makes you think that you can beat him?
So, as you mentioned, he's never faced a primary challenger. There hasn't been a competitive primary in this district since I was 5 years old. It's been a long time, 2002. And that shows he has not really tested with the voters in terms of his ideas, in terms of what he's done. And I think that many people, especially as you mentioned, we've had over 750 people contribute to this campaign, meaning that they really found resonance with our message. They believe in this idea of full-time representation, this idea of listening, that I've been going around to every single community meeting, you know, the NYPD Community Council, all these different community events, that I'm there, that I'm present, that I want to learn what matters to them. And I think it shows that people want that type of representation, and that's what makes me believe that, you know, we live in a district where people want to see a representative who wants the job, who wants to do it full-time and wants to do it well. And so far, there's been a great response to that.
So I guess a question that a lot of people have made issue about is your age and electability. If not political experience, what experience do you have that makes you think you can do this job well?
Well, I like to say, you know, I've been listening and present in this district for 22 years. I mean, I've been around, and whether it was volunteering through my temple's mitzvah corps, whether it was through volunteering at All Souls Soup Kitchen, whether it's just being around and knowing all the local business owners for my entire life, I think that's tremendous experience, and that's really understanding the pulse of a community. And as you mentioned, you know, political versus non-political experience, I think they blend together in a way, in that, yes, you obviously maybe want someone who's written a bill before, but how helpful is that when the person has been serving for 9 years and has only really been passing laws to benefit their own career arc and not their constituents?
Okay, so I guess we can talk about your time at Yale. What activities were you involved in on campus? Did you do anything, you know, politics related while you were there?
So I told you I had a political radio show. That was my biggest time commitment at Yale for sure. I was on once a week for 7 semesters. So I think we had about 12 episodes, like 85 episodes or so.
Wow.
I know, a lot of talking, hour-long episodes. It was a lot of fun. We called ourselves The Fireside. And that was, I mean, I also did a sports talk show, and also, so I've actually been to Columbia a couple times. I was the voice of the Yale Bulldogs on the radio, and
awesome.
We clinched the Ivy League title at Columbia my freshman year.
Oh, no.
And I came, we called the game. The call was picked up by Sports Illustrated, actually, because Yale hadn't made the NCAA tournament since 1969. So it was all very exciting. I spent a lot of time on the radio station. I mean, I was on the board of it, but it was so much fun. And it was great to, I mean, I think the idea of getting to interview my elected officials, getting to really engage in politics every single week was very helpful in me really becoming politically active and understanding all the issues.
Mm. So, I mean, I guess that definitely makes sense. But on this issue of, you know, I think a lot of people have said that you're a younger candidate, and what we've seen from a lot of younger candidates recently is they tend to be very left. And I think that many people describe your platform as pretty centrist. And I think you've previously called yourself a pragmatic progressive. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Yes, I would call myself a pragmatic progressive. I do think, as you mentioned, that there is a tendency to label younger people running for office kind of and lump them into the bucket of the DSA type. And that's not where I'm coming from. I'm not running a challenge from the left. I'm not running a challenge from the right. I'm not really running a challenge. I'm running a challenge from the young, I would say, in that I believe that young people should be running to try and restore our belief in our government, to try and really focus on ethics. And that's why I said to you, that's one of my number one things. And I don't think that that's something that a Democrat or a Republican would really agree or disagree on any more than one another. I think ethics in general is just something that gets to the very essence of our democracy. Now, to the specific term pragmatic progressive, I'm a progressive, but I also understand how our city works, how our state works, and how there are certain issues. You know, in a perfect world, I would love if we could have a Medicaid for All system in New York State, the New York State Health Act that's being talked about. But you look at the way that New York State is running its Medicaid program right now with a massive deficit, $4 billion deficit. One that's contributing to a $6 billion deficit that Governor Cuomo is trying to fix. If we were to expand it to a Medicaid for All program for the entire state, with already the cost overruns and the way that it's been done, I don't think we can do that. We have to be pragmatic about what we can really accomplish and about, you know, we can get to creating a public option. And then, you know, at a certain point, maybe we can have Medicaid for All. But I don't think that calling for that or that's an issue. Or whether it's, you know, on real estate development. I have really said, you know, I support a cap. I support, you know, I oppose the Northwell project. You know, I support the opposition to it, the Committee to Save Our Lenox Hill Neighborhood. But in the same way, we had recent rent laws that were passed, which, you know, 90% of them were good, but 10% of them did make it very difficult. If you are a property owner, if you want to make an improvement to your property, MCI or an IAI, a major capital improvement or an individual apartmental improvement, you can't really do that because they capped at what you can raise your rents. You might say, well, that's great for the tenant. They can't get their rents raised, but not so great if there's a major problem in your apartment and the property owner has no desire to make it better because they can't raise the rent. You know, in a certain point, you need to incentivize investment in the housing stock. And so that's why I would define myself as a pragmatic progressive.
So to clarify back there, you're talking about the Housing Stability and Tenant Protection Act that was recently passed. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah.
And you said it needs to be amended.
I would like it to be amended. I don't think it will be amended, but I think, and here's the problem too, because you're going to have people that are going to want to try and amend it and really roll back a lot of the tenant protections, which were very good. You know, it's great that we got rid of a tenant blacklist. It's great that we made it very difficult to evict somebody. But in the same way, we have to be smart. We have an affordable housing crisis, and we're not going to get out of it if we don't incentivize anybody to build anything, and we also don't incentivize our property owners to keep their housing stock in good repair. And you're already seeing it beginning to happen. You had the case with Blackstone and I think Tudor City. You have people that are like, why am I going to keep renovating? Why am I going to keep updating if I can't, you know, if financially it's impossible? So we're going to have to find a middle ground. I think the state will maybe eventually come to that conclusion, but I think at the very least, in a district that has been seen as pragmatic, it's good to have someone saying that and acknowledging it.
So another issue that we touched on earlier but haven't really delved into deeply, I guess we can do that now, is this issue of vacant retail storefronts. And you wrote an op-ed back in December about this. 1 in 8 retail storefronts being vacant. What do you see as the reason for these vacancies, and what is your plan to fix it?
Yeah, so our vacancy rate's about 13%, as you said, and it's gotten way worse in recent years. It was about 7% or so, 8%, just like 5-6 years ago. The problem is, you know, you have some people that are saying it's all about the rent, and the rent is too high, and it's just, you know, impossible with this rent to have a business. And I agree, the rent is very high, but if you look at what's happened on 3rd Avenue, for example, the rent has gone down by 40% in the past few years, yet vacancy has creeped up even a little bit more. So the idea that a commercial rent control or a vacancy tax is going to solve the problem is incorrect. We need to understand two things. One, it's very hard to be a small business in New York City right now. I've talked to enough of the small business owners that there's so many onerous taxes, whether it's the property tax system, which continues to rise due to the way that we assess, whether it's the commercial rent tax. So you pay 4% tax on your commercial rent if you pay a certain amount in rent. And that's regardless of your profit or your income. It's just a tax you pay on the rent. So it's not very easy to open up a small business like that, to get a use change, to get a permit from the state liquor authority. So there's a lack of demand in that regard. And then the second thing is, and you would recognize this, I think everybody on this campus knows, like the market's different. Amazon has changed things, and e-commerce has made things very different. So you might say, well, let's just let the market take its course then. And the response is, well, no, because retail is very important to the health of our communities. You know, I love living in New York City because it's a place where there are local mom-and-pop shops, local businesses. It's not a place of big-box retailers. And I love urban planning. I love Jane Jacobs. I've read a lot of Jane Jacobs. And she's said, you know, you need to have healthy sidewalks, you know, with mixed use and filled retail to have a healthy community. So we need these. There's a positive good that comes from that. And the final thing I'll note is, and I've been talking about this with lawmakers. I've been talking about this in many community meetings now. You look on the streets. I even saw it when we were getting here. You have just trucks kind of unloading Amazon packages everywhere you look. And there's no regard for the fact that this is not allowed by city law. Trucks cannot just be parking, unloading, and setting up basically a distribution center on the corner of whatever street they want. We have vacant storefronts. Some of them should be filled with businesses that we can bring back by creating a better business climate. But the other way to do it is to make sure that we've leveled the playing field. And so maybe Amazon should actually start using these vacant storefronts as the package distribution centers. Maybe that's what actually should be happening there, as opposed to going rent-free on our city streets and doing it. And if you go to a community board meeting with me, which anyone on this campus is more than welcome to come if they want.
Invitation noted.
Invitation. Believe me, community board 8 is especially fun. They can get raucous sometimes. If you go, you'll hear so many people talk about on their block this issue. And it's not, you know, it's not something that's brought up once a meeting. It's brought up 10 to 15 times. And it's because, you know, the city's had some enforcement problems. I won't go into that. But we've made it very easy for online retailers to just circumvent all of our rules. We just changed our internet sales tax structure. We're working to make sure that the sales tax equivalent, but it's all these types of things. It shouldn't be easier to buy something online than it is to buy something in retail, other than the fact that you're doing it with clicks. But price-wise, and they should be subject to all the different, you know, red tape that a regular retailer goes through as well.
I want to shift this conversation to a bit more nationally. And I think your progressive platform, you've talked about being in favor of full legalization of marijuana. Can you talk a little about like the rationale behind that? And do you think that's plausible?
Yes. So in this state and in many states across this country, there's been an incarceration crisis in terms of people who have been in prison for very long times, had their lives ruined. It's affected their families, their entire communities, because of our overburdensome marijuana legislation, which has been specifically targeted communities of color too. So what we need to have happen in New York is a legalization. We need to do it on a regional level because you need to make sure that you're not kind of throwing off the market people doing something in New Jersey, New York, you know, Massachusetts already legalized, but we're working with Connecticut, Pennsylvania. So all these states around are trying to do it together. I think that's a very good idea because Colorado and Washington immediately was odd that they had it legalized and the rest of the country didn't. You know, in a federal system, we expect federalism, but this is a lot of federalism. The second point, though, is, and I think the entire country will have to grapple with this. As I mentioned, marijuana laws have disproportionately hurt communities of color. And how can we then take the positives that come from marijuana legalization, so the increased revenue that we get from it, and how do we make sure that those are shared amongst those communities? Well, we can earmark some of the funds, which I think is a good idea, and that's been talked about in the legislature, to make sure that it goes to programs in those communities to help mobility, economic mobility. But then there's also the point that we want to make sure that MWBEs are getting in on some of the marijuana contracts, that it's not just white people who are having these marijuana dispensaries and these businesses, that everyone has a chance and that we really do a good job of opening up and democratizing it. And that's why, quite frankly, New York hasn't legalized it yet, because it's very easy to say, as I say, you know, marijuana should be legal. But it's not as easy to say, where should the money go? Should it go to the state's general fund? Should it be more earmarked towards communities that were affected by marijuana legislation? Are there certain strings attached that we should have about localities? Because, example, Long Island and Westchester don't really want it as much. And there are certain towns or counties that say, could we opt out? That's also being determined. So there's a lot of different moving parts there, as I've explained. I support legalization, and you know, I'd have to see what exactly the plan would be. The governor wants to legalize it in the budget, which means you can't really vote for the plan on a piecemeal basis. I think it should be done by legislation, and we can see where exactly that money, you know, it's going to probably be $400 million, $500 million of annual tax revenue, where it's going.
So I want to shift the conversation now to you personally. I guess I'm just legitimately curious. Politics, especially in this moment in our country, it's pretty nasty. It's chaotic. What even drew you to this field in the first place? Why do you want to work in politics?
It's a funny question, and you're not the first to ask me that. I agree. It's a sad time politically, but I think that actually has motivated me in some ways because, you know, we have grown up seeing a polarized climate where there's so much mudslinging and there's so much hatred and animosity on both sides, throwing back and forth and talking past each other. And I think that we need new people, kind of a fresh perspective of people that really want to come in and want to make a difference. I want to get to Albany and I want to get to work on issues that benefit the quality of life of my constituents. That's where I want to go to Albany. I want to make my community a better place. And I think that if we have a new generation that's coming in, that's doing that, that really just wants to serve, to help their community, to make their community better, and is working hard every day to do that, I think we can then get out of this state where, you know, Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, whatever, I don't think anybody is happy with our current political state right now. And I don't think anybody likes the dialogue we have in our country, in our state, in our city, because it does seem that everything is so nasty, as you said.
Did you come from, you know, a family that had conversations with politics at the dinner table? I guess, you know, can you tell me a little bit about your background and where you're coming from?
We talked politics at the dinner table, but, you know, no one in my family had ever worked in politics, had ever run for office or anything. And other than, you know, going with my mom to vote back in, I can remember going to vote for John Kerry in 2004. That was the first time I remember walking into PS RFK High School or middle school on like 88th between Park and Lex. I remember walking in and being fascinated by the fact that the school's gym had become a polling place. So,
yeah.
I mean, I've been politically active in that regard with my family. But, you know, they're just a normal in terms of no more politically active than the next. They vote, which is good enough. Yeah. Some can't
that's
say
important.
That, sadly,
yeah, that's
in this country.
Right. Did you become interested in politics, you know, in high school, in college, I guess, or had it always been there?
I'd always been interested. In high school, I definitely took it to the next level. I spent a semester in Washington, D.C. at this place called the School for Ethics and Global Leadership. So it was a semester program, 24 kids from around the country, and, you know, lived, breathed, ate politics every single day. And also, ethics has a component there. I've been talking about ethics. My major at Yale was ethics, politics, and economics. So I think that that also has kind of really shaped the way that I see this.
So you've made incredible gains in fundraising. As we talked a little bit about before, you've raised $449,323 since you started campaigning in late October. And I mean, that's really impressive considering, you know, you're a pretty upstart campaign. What is the experience of starting, of building a campaign from the ground up?
So coming in, it was pretty crazy because the incumbent had about $700,000 in the bank, obviously split between his DA and his assembly account, but it's so much money. And we were basically told, you know, why are you doing this? You don't stand a chance. It just doesn't work. You're going up against so much money. And so, you know, every single day, pounded the pavement around the community. And it was just meeting as many people as possible, calling as many people as possible, really understanding everyone in this district and them kind of knowing who I was. And people really began to believe in this message and contributed, which was amazing. And to have, I think, 99% of the money, or more than 99% of the money, come from individuals, not from corporations or PACs, is something that I'm very, very pleased with. Because you look at some other assembly campaign finance reports, all these interest groups and corporations are the ones that are funding everything, and it's not coming from individuals. We have a lot of broken things in our campaign finance system, and Citizens United I would put at the top. You have issues about, you know, max contribution levels and a lack of public financing, which the state is fixing and will be fixed in 2024. But to have done this with 750-plus individuals, to have done this in the period that we did, going up against a Goliath of sorts of my opponent's fundraising, we're really pleased and we're excited.
So how did you get the idea to run for assembly? You know, I'm in college right now.
Are you thinking about it?
I don't think
By the way, there's a 19-year-old running for state senate in Long Island.
Wow. So. Okay. Yeah. So
you're older than him.
That's right. I mean, I guess how did you get this idea? What kind of sparked it?
Well, I had always said after 2016 that I needed to do something, and then over the summer, I don't know what exactly set it off. I mean, it's every day just like seeing the vacant storefronts and doing a little bit more research, kind of, you know, what's affecting this? Like, who's making laws on this in my community that really are going to change the vacancy crisis? And I had heard plenty about congestion pricing. I had heard about these other issues so much. I mean, I'm very active in politics and, you know, read all this stuff every single day. And then I saw that my current assembly member was running for district attorney, that he had thrown his hat in the race 2 years out, mind you, from this election. And I said to myself, you know, we have all these problems. They need to be fixed. I've lived here my entire life, and I'm passionate about it. And, you know, everyone who I talk to who I would complain about the vacant storefronts or I'd complain about congestion price, and they'd be like, well, why don't you do something about it? And I said over the summer, I was like, you know, why don't I do something about it? I've always talked about wanting to make a difference, wanting to make a change, and I think this is the best way to do it. And, you know, it started out, then I asked my campaign manager, also a very good friend of mine. I said, you know, I want to do this. Will you join me in doing this? And he went to Siegel, the School for Ethics and Global Leadership,
okay,
with me. And he said, sure, I'm all in. And he had worked on Seth Moulton's presidential campaign and, you know, done Columbia Journalism School and worked for Rachel Maddow's show. So he had some media savvy and a little political experience.
Yeah.
And we dove in head first. And here we are 6 months later in the heat of an assembly primary where my opponent's already been slinging mud at me.
So I guess we can conclude with this final question. I'll just give you a chance to pitch yourself one last time. The Upper East Side is home to over 200,000 New Yorkers. If you can give them all one reason why they should vote for you come June.
You know, it's very rare that you can vote in a state assembly primary where you can take a stand and actually vote for better government, where you can take a stand and say, I am voting for someone who wants to restore representation to the way it should be, for full-time representation, to cap outside income, to actually create an independent ethics enforcement commission. Because New York State is the most corrupt state in the country. In the past 10 years, we had 30-plus lawmakers who were indicted or convicted. New York wins a lot. We're the best, in my opinion. And that's one thing that we are not the best in by any means. And for everyone who lives on the Upper East Side or in Midtown or Murray Hill or Sutton Place, when they go to the polls on June 23rd, if they want to vote for restoring their confidence in their state government and for knowing that the person who serves them in Albany really cares and really wants to get things done and really wants to make their life better, that's what's driving this, then they should cast their vote for me. And it would be an honor to serve them in the assembly.
Your candidacy is so exciting. And it seems like, you know, a lot of people say you need to wait your time. But I guess for Cameron Kaufman, that time is now. So,
that's our slogan.
That's right.
There's no time to waste. And hopefully, you know, people in the district are excited about it. And hopefully anyone here who's a student at Columbia, if you want to get involved and volunteer, we have plenty of college students who are now helping out. We have some NYU people. Fordham is getting excited. So,
do you have a website you want to plug?
CameronKaufman.com.
Okay, yeah, no, be sure to check that out.
And follow us on TikTok and then on all other forms of social media too.
That's awesome.
But TikTok's new.
Cameron, thanks so much for taking the time to come in, be on the show, and talk to me.
No, thank you.
Really enjoyed it. All right.
That's all for today. This episode was produced and edited by Samuel Hyman. It was written, hosted, and produced by William Yuan Yi. You've been listening to Mumble Jumble, a WKCR News production. For more information about our podcast and WKCR News, please visit WKCR.org. Thank you for listening. See you next week.